Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce David Boudanis, the author of Einstein's Greatest Mistake that he'll be talking about. I had him come here for a lecture on his book on Madame du Châtelet and Voltaire several years ago, which was great. Great lecture, great book. On a woman scientist that has been ignored, not totally ignored, but certainly doesn't get her due. She translated Newton's work as he was doing it into French to keep the French scientists abreast of what Newton was up to in England, among other things that she did. So if there are no other questions, let me just tell you a little bit about other things that David has done. David has studied mathematics, physics, and history at the University of Chicago, and for many years taught the Intellectual Toolkit course at Oxford University. He's the author of many books, including the one I mentioned, and the New York Times bestseller, The Secret House, and E equals MC squared, which was adapted as the PBS Nova documentary, Einstein's Big Idea. David Boudanis is also a futurist and a business advisor. He lives in London, and he came all the way to tell you about Einstein's greatest mistakes. Thank you very much, David.
I love this gavel. I wish I'd had one when I was a kid. I'm going to begin by reading just a little bit from the book, the beginning of the introduction. Then I'll talk for about half an hour, and then we can have lots of questions. I really look forward to that. So here's how the book begins. It's in Princeton, 1953. The tourists generally stayed on the sidewalk across the street from the big white house in Princeton. But it was hard to keep down their excitement once they spotted the old man walking slowly back from the university. He often wore a long cloth coat, and if the New Jersey wind was especially sharp, he had a dark knit cap over his famous hair. The bravest of the tourists sometimes crossed over to say how much they admired him or to ask for his autograph. Most, however, were too tongue-tied. They were too awed to speak, and they kept a respectful distance. For this old man was Albert Einstein, the greatest genius of all time, and he was just yards away from them, his wise, wrinkled face, suggesting he'd see achieved insights deeper than any other humans possibly could. Einstein was the most famous scientist alive, but despite his celebrity, he usually walked alone, or occasionally with just one old friend. Although he was celebrated in public, and still constantly invited to white tie dinners and even movie openings, Hollywood stars were excited to be photographed next to him. Working scientists had little to do with him, nor had they for many, many years. It wasn't his age that made him that made them treat him this way. The great Danish physicist Niels Bohr was about the same age. Einstein was 74. But Bohr remained so open to new ideas that bright doctoral students liked nothing more than spending time with him at his intellectually sparkling institute in Copenhagen. Einstein, however, had been isolated from mainstream research for decades. There was polite applause, of course, on the few occasions when he gave a seminar at the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, but it was the applause one might give an elderly soldier being wheeled out onto a stage. Einstein's peers regarded him as a has-been. Even many of his closest friends no longer took his ideas seriously. Einstein could sense his isolation. At one time, his own house would have been full of colleagues, of youthful energy, the buzz of conversation. But lately, it had become quiet. His second wife, Elsa, had passed away several years before, as had his beloved younger sister, Maya. His sister's death especially pained Einstein. Maya and Albert had been constant companions as children, back in 1880s Munich, 70 years earlier, teasing each other and building card castles. If a particularly elaborate card castle collapsed in a gust of air, she remembered, her brother would doggedly start building it back up again. Quote, "I might not be more skilled than other scientists," he liked to say, "but I have the persistence of a mule." Einstein had retained his youthful stubbornness, but his health wasn't what it had been. His main room, where he had his books and papers, was upstairs in his Princeton home, down the hall from the bedroom that had been Maya's. At his age, Einstein could climb the stairs only slowly, pausing for breath. But maybe it didn't matter. When he did settle in his study, he would have all the time in the world. He was the greatest mind of the modern age. How had he ended up so alone? How that happened, how genius reaches its peak and how it fades, how we deal with failure and with aging, how we lose the habit of trust and whether we can ever get it back. Those are the topics of this book. So too are Einstein's ideas and the steps by which he arrived at them. In that sense, it's actually a double biography. It's the story of a fallible genius, but also the story of his mistakes, how they began, how they grew, how they locked in, so deeply that even a man as wise as Einstein was unable to work himself free. Genius and hubris, triumph and failure, these can be inextricable. Einstein's great equations, his great theories, were perhaps the greatest feat of his life, yet they sowed the seeds for his most astonishing failures. To understand what Einstein did achieve and how he went wrong, it's necessary to go even further back in time, to Einstein's earlier years and the mysteries that intrigued him even then. I wrote that beginning about 2 years ago, and I was so excited to find a right angle into Einstein. I'd written about him a decade before in Equals MC Squared, and I wanted to do more. That book, Equals MC Squared, only touched on Einstein a little bit. It was mostly about the equation. And I wanted to go into him as a person to really get across, what was he like? Not just the random things, what food he ate. By the way, those of you who wish to be like Einstein should have strawberries and scrambled eggs for breakfast. He loved strawberries and scrambled eggs. He also loved sitting in the bathtub for hours, well, on end. He was also, when he was supposed to work, he'd either play the violin or he would noodle away on the piano. He loved improvising on the piano, especially when he got older. He had a blue parakeet, blah, blah, blah. One can go on to all these externals, but I love those. The book's full of them. The new book's full of them. But I also wanted to go into, what was he like as a person in the deepest realm? Where did he actually come from? And then I thought, I can't do an entire biography of him. That's a huge topic. But what if I pick this one angle? What made him so incredibly intelligent, so much overwhelmingly better than anybody else? I point out I grew up in the city where Michael Jordan played basketball. I understand what it's like to see skill greater than any other person who seems to be very good in their field. And then how did he go wrong? And then why did he lock into his errors? So how did he get so good? How did he get really good? Not just smart, but exceptional. Then where did he go wrong and why did he lock in? And then how did that destroy his life? So that's what the book's about. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit now. And again, as I mentioned, I'd love questions and a discussion afterwards. Einstein was born just before the 20th century began, 1879 in Germany, to a kind of assimilated German-Jewish family. And the most important thing about him, I think, about his childhood, was their sense of humor. They had a distinctive way not of getting caught up in things, but being kind of wry and commenting on whatever happened. When he was a little boy, he took a big, heavy ball, and he threw it at Maya's head. And she wrote about that later, and she said, you know, that shows it takes a thick skull to be the sister of a world-famous physicist. And I love that tone. Instead of getting offended, Mom, he picked on me, you have that whimsical humor. You can step back and view things nicely. A few years later, when Einstein was in high school, he took a Greek in his high school in Munich, and his professor, Professor Dagenhart, did not like him and said, Einstein, you'll never amount to anything. And the sister said, and indeed, my brother never taught Greek in high school in Munich. And that's great. Isn't it nice? They sometimes say that to make you feel bad, two people are involved. One person who slurs you and the other person who lets it bounce off. I have a friend who's in London, where I live, who's very short, and her daughter at age 5 was really, really tiny. On the daughter's first day of school, some of the other kids started making fun of her. The daughter had a wonderful personality. She's now grown up. The daughter crossed her arms at age 5 and said to the other girl, you know, with that attitude, I don't think you're going to have a lot of friends. Isn't it wonderful to stand up like that? And that makes you really bold. When adversity comes in life, and adversity comes a real lot at us, with that attitude, you can overcome it. You sometimes read about somebody's career, and it seems inevitable. Wow, right to the top. Almost always, they had friends when they were young who were as good as them, who were skilled and positive and energetic and intelligent, whatever it takes. But the ones who succeed often have the ability to slough off adversity, not to be wildly arrogant, then you don't listen to what's going on, but just having an inner confidence. And Einstein's family gave that to him. When he was 4 years old, he wanted to walk around the city of Munich, and his parents said, fine, we trust you, it'll be safe. The first time he walked around, either his mother or his father stood behind him, like 10 or 20 yards behind, and just checked that he would look both ways at street corners and stuff. So they were sensible. And the fact he did look both ways. And so after that, they let him travel around by himself. And it's a lovely sort of liberation. Anyways, when the family, when he was 15, his dad, who was an electrical contractor, did lighting systems and stuff, was finding he wasn't getting many good contracts in Munich. There wasn't extreme anti-Semitism. It was more like genteel, moderate anti-Semitism. He would go offers, and people would say, well, you know, it was pretty good, but we're going to go for the other firm. And that happened over and over. So his family decided, let's try northern Italy. Let's move to Milan, or outside Milan, and let's set up a small electrical contracting factory there. And they left Einstein behind to finish high school. He stayed with family friends. That's when he met Professor Dagenhart, his Greek teacher. Anyways, Einstein hated that. He loved education, of course, but he hated the Prussian-style educational system. So he did something which I think we've all wanted to do. He left. He just walked out. He left high school. He didn't officially sign out. He just left. And he crossed the Alps on his own at age 15. Possibly a locomotive helped him. And he arrived at his family's house. Me voilà. Here I am. And they said, you finished high school early. He said, however, he said, there's a good university in Switzerland in the German language which will take people without a high school degree if you pass an entrance exam, a great polytechnic in Zurich. So they said, okay, we trust you. You're a bright boy. And he took the entrance exam. Now, there's a myth which you can see in Rocky Part 1, which unfortunately Sylvester Stallone got a little bit of the script wrong. Einstein was actually not a terrible student. He was a pretty good B-plus or A-minus student. And he took the entrance exams for the Zurich Polytechnic, and he did okay. He was good in math and physics, as you can imagine. He was okay in chemistry. He was freehand drawing was good. Not great, but good. But his Latin, he hadn't studied his Latin, and I think some of his European history was poor. And they said, well, you can do it again in 1 year. He was only 16, so it's no problem to do it later. So he moved in with a family nearby of a family. The father was a high school principal. He fell in love with the daughter. At one point, it seems, he said to the daughter, you can do my laundry. And she wasn't that overwhelmed. Finally, he got into the university on a second chance. The university, the letters in German are ETH, and it's known as that. And he was an okay student, except when the professors were out of date. And one of his professors, a man named here Professor Weber, Professor Dr. Weber, Heinrich Weber, I think it was, wouldn't do any up-to-date information. His lecture notes were old, and Einstein couldn't stand it, and he started teasing him. Instead of calling him Dr. Professor, he called him Mr. Weber, Herr Weber. Weber did not like that. The Germans are very formal. And he also started skipping class. He cut class, and he loved mochas, you know, chocolate in his coffee. And sit at the cafes in Zurich. He's real friendly. He'd gossip with whoever came in. But when he wasn't gossiping or drinking, having his coffee, he'd also read in the philosophers and read in more modern physicists. Turns out a lot of thinkers do that. They get some good training, but then they have to spend a little bit of time on their own. If they spend too long on their own, it's no good. But if they spend a little bit of time on their own, it's pretty good. Think of somebody, say, who's doing computer science. They train well, they drop out after a year or two and want to work on things on their own and then come back to university, back to high tech, something like that. So university was fairly good for Einstein, but there was one part of university which was wonderful for him. Her name was Mileva Maric, and she was a girl from Belgrade, a Serbian girl, and she was tough and cool and smart. She had traveled by herself from Belgrade to Zurich, and she entered the university studying physics. That's impressive even today. She was also slightly handicapped. She had a strong limp, probably from tuberculosis when she was little. So she was a tough, cool lady. She spoke three or four languages. And there were six boys in the class and one girl. We think of Einstein today as this funny-looking old man with the big white hair. But when he was young, it's pretty cute. There's pictures of him looking good. And when he was a sailor also, and people remarked when he took his shirt off, he was quite fit. You think of Einstein, the action hero. Anyways, he knew how to court a girl, because remember, he had the experience from high school. And he told his friends, that one, that's going to be for me. And he did something very wild. His letters have survived. And he sent her something, a token of just to show how much he loved her. And she didn't know what it was going to be. Was it going to be an erotic poem in the style of Rambo? Was it going to be maybe a recipe that his mother had made for him and now she could make for him? Mm-mm. It was a drawing. And he drew and sent her a picture of his foot, because his feet sweated a lot, and she could knit him nice woolen socks. She did knit him nice woolen socks. By the way, we know his feet sweated a lot because he volunteered for the Swiss Army, and he was turned down for having flat feet and sweaty feet, the poor man. That was good. He also was charming, and they decided that they were going to be like Marie and Pierre Curie. They were going to be romantically in love, and they would do science together. It was wonderful. They went on not a skiing holiday, but they went in the snows above Lake Como, where George Clooney famously had a house a century later. And it was cold there, and their letters survived. They hugged. They really hugged, because 9 months later, she gave birth to their... to their first child, and this actually led to the destruction of their marriage. It's very sad. The child was, they named her Elizabeth, Lisserelle in German slang, and she was born out of wedlock. And at that time, for middle-class families, you couldn't keep a child that was born out of wedlock. Now it's very different, but those were the mores then. So they had to give her up to adoption. Einstein never saw her. His wife, Mileva, went back to Budapest. And of course, a letter of his survives, where he said, how wonderful. What does she have? Your eyes. I'm in love with her and I've never seen her. But they had to give her up. And they seemed to have been as careful as they could. Mileva had a friend from school who was married and lived near Belgrade, and they seemed to have given the child to her. So they wanted the best for it. Anyways, after that, they had two more boys, but something was gone in the relationship. Something had fundamentally changed. You know, they sometimes say that when you're courting somebody, you look at the stars. And when you get married, you look at the bills. And it's kind of a shame. It doesn't have to be like that. But Einstein gradually grew apart from his first wife. Again, they had two boys, and he was really nice with the kids. He was good with his hands because of his dad being a contractor. He would make matchboxes, and he'd make them into cable cars with strings and stuff and just play with the kids. It was great. But even so, 100 years ago, dads weren't that hands-on. And he managed to continue. He had a great job at a patent office in Bern, Switzerland. And she had to stay at home taking care of the kids. And when their old university friends would visit, they could all be together. But then when somebody else would visit, they wanted to hang out with Einstein. And she would try to join them because she was a well-trained physicist. The kid cries. He looks at her. She goes off and changes the diaper. Maybe takes 20 minutes. So she comes in later, and you've kind of lost the conversation flow. And after enough of that, you don't even join the conversation at all. And that made her sour, it made her negative, it made him difficult. And the relationship fell apart, it left him kind of isolated. And also, he was working at the patent office, which was a nice civil service job. But it wasn't what he had wanted. He dreamed of something. It wasn't clear yet what it was, but he had a vision. And his vision was something that was once described by the great Scottish physicist Maxwell in the 1800s. And Einstein always had a portrait of Maxwell over his desk, along with Newton and sometimes Faraday. Maxwell said, is the universe like a book, or is it like a magazine? If it's like a book, it hangs together. There's an author of some sort, and there's a pattern to it. And we can look in and try to see that pattern. If it's a magazine, there might be interesting little subsets, but they're just kind of random. Something here, something there. It doesn't really hold together. Maxwell, from his religious beliefs, was convinced it was a book. We would have a chance of understanding it. And Einstein actually had that view also. His religion was kind of like this. Over here, imagine one extreme is complete atheism, and another extreme on the other side is following a quote-unquote standard religion in great detail. Einstein was against atheism. He thought it was unscientific. He thought also atheists were often angry people in his time, and he didn't like the fact that they were paying no attention to the thing they were critiquing, at least very often. Nor was he follow standard details of standard religion. So Einstein believed that, the Ten Commandments were probably very wise insights, and there may have been a man named Moses, but Einstein didn't believe that they came from God on Mount Sinai. Instead, he went for a realm in between. And the philosopher that really guided him was Spinoza, the Dutch Jewish philosopher of the 1600s. Did we lose the sound? Oh, there we have it. Einstein really followed Spinoza, who believed, as sort of what's sometimes called pantheism, that there's patterns in the universe, that there's subtle, significant forms, which aren't the same as the standard religious deity, but aren't chance, and it's worth studying them. Einstein said one time when he was a little bit older, he said he felt like a little boy walking into a library, and the room was dark. It was a single big room, and the walls were lined with books. And in those books were the secrets of the universe. And most of the time, the room was dark, cloudy, maybe foggy. We couldn't see them. But very occasionally, the wisest member of our species could walk across the room, could go to the far wall and take down one of the books and open it up. And you would see these truths that had been there waiting. On one page, it might say E equals MC squared. Another page might have the Sermon on the Mount, right, from the New Testament. And then we'd have to close the book, put it back up on the shelf, and then go out. And Einstein believed that all that was waiting. So he was really frustrated in his 20s after he finished university and didn't have an academic job. He was working in the patent office, 1903, 1904, early 1905. His sister Maya loved him. His parents loved him. His wife loved him, and they respected him. But he hadn't really done much, and it hurt. And then in 1905, he started getting really good ideas, E equals MC squared and other things. And then in 1907, he came across a problem that he couldn't solve, and he couldn't get out of his head. Suppose somebody's standing on a diving board. You feel gravity pulling you down on the diving board. It's like it's holding you there. You jump off the diving board. Imagine a high board, like 10 meters from the Olympics, which I couldn't do. I think I've done 3 meters with extreme fear, and only fear of humiliation allows me to jump forward holding my nose and squishing my eyes. When you jump off a diving board, suppose you don't feel the wind, you don't feel the air flowing by you. Well, the gravity seems to have disappeared. While you're in free fall, you actually don't feel anything. And that troubled Einstein. Where does the gravity go? He couldn't understand that. And he studied that problem for 8 years, and that led, which I describe at greater length in the book, to what's called general relativity. As I can give a metaphor that gives an image of what he did. He came up with a beautiful vision. Before him, everybody thought that outer space was just flat. Outer space was like, imagine a trampoline or a rubber sheet or a bed in the United States Marine Corps, which is totally flat and taut, right? And if you have like a rubbery trampoline that's really taut and flat, take a little ball bearing and just flick it, pew, like that. It'll go across the rubbery sheet just in a straight line. It's no surprise. Now, however, and that little ball bearing could be like the planet Earth. Now take a big, heavy rock and put it in the middle of that trampoline. It'll bend the trampoline down. It'll kind of sag in the middle, right? That's like our sun. And he believed that it would actually make space around it sag down. Now if you take a little ball bearing and flick it, as it goes towards that sagging bit, it'll whip around a corner, kind of like a ball in a pool table or a British billiard table, whips around the corner and back. That was a beautiful vision, and Einstein thought, wow, everything's like that. The moon goes around a sort of like a curved, sagging bit in space where the Earth curves, pulls space down, and the Earth itself goes around the sun because the sun sags down that rubber sheet and we go around it. And he developed this whole vision in a really simple form to describe the whole universe. That, he said, was the greatest achievement of his life. Unfortunately, it began to lead to the greatest problem. Because when he analyzed what he had done, he realized in 1917, when he was in his late 30s, oh my God, this predicts the universe is expanding for various reasons that I describe in the book. It predicts the universe is expanding. But that didn't make any sense, because when he asked his astronomer friends, is the universe expanding? In 1917, everybody said, nope, we've studied it, we're the experts. All the experimental evidence says the universe is not expanding. The universe is just static. There's lots of stars in our Milky Way galaxy, and they're just sitting there, hovering in position, and beyond it, there's nothing. There's a great void, sort of like Donald Trump's brain. There's just this angry magnetic storms, you know, going there. So Einstein had to say, okay, well, maybe this beautiful, simple equation, this beautiful, simple image that I just described to you, of heavy objects like the sun sagging down space around it, and that explaining how everything moved and why things curve around, maybe my vision isn't right. So he had to lacerate his vision and add all sorts of extra terms and just make it ugly. He never liked to do that. 10 years later, in about 1929 or 1930, astronomers realized, oi, they said. They probably didn't say oi, I'm translating. Oi, they said, we were wrong. The universe is expanding, and it's expanding fast. And Einstein said, I knew it. I should have had the guts, he said, to have stuck to my original vision. I had a clear vision. I had this intuition. It was simple. It was crisp. And it matched the idea that the universe is a book. It matched the idea that God, or what he called the old one, had created something with these very simple forms. And I was lucky enough. I was able to see it. He was excited by that. He thought it was wonderful. And he vowed, and this is where his big mistake came in. It wasn't, I think, a terrible mistake to be wrong about going along with the astronomers. Anybody can make a mistake like that. What he did next was his big mistake. He vowed he would never get carried away by experimental evidence again, because the experimentalists, they'd been wrong. For 10 years, they'd been wrong when they said the universe was not expanding, that it was static. And then when they said, oh, it was, by the way, you can go back to that beautiful vision you had before where everything is clear and everything's exact and everything is simple, Einstein thought, I should have had the guts. I should have just held my nerve. Okay, so far, so good. But then, this is around the time, just when quantum mechanics was coming in, and we won't go into detail of it here. I talk about it more in the books. But quantum mechanics is the study of the ultra-small electrons or actions on that level, often inside an atom. And Einstein had been involved with it a little bit. And one of the things that scientists were finding, they'd been studying it on and off through the 20th century, but especially in the mid-1920s and late 1920s, it was getting stronger. They were seeing that if you look really, really closely, everything gets a little bit blurry. It's sort of like from afar you see the waves coming into the coast in San Francisco, and they seem these beautiful swelling patterns. But if you look really close, there's often foam on the waves, and you can see the waves form a pattern. But the exact details of the foam, you can't really tell. It seems kind of a matter of chance or randomness, which way that little bit of foam right on the tip, which way is it going to break, left or right? How far is it going to go up? Will it touch this grain of sand or fall back before the other? And quantum mechanics, again, this is just an analogy. In the book, I go in more detail. Quantum mechanics was a little bit like that. It was. It suggested that on the fundamental level, we won't be able to see things super clearly. We can have certain overall patterns, but the details are going to be forever out of our grasp. We can have probabilities. We know that even though we can't see the details of a wave, there's that foam and uncertainty, it's not going to, unless there's a tidal wave, it's going to be within certain parameters, it won't go up too high. We can make predictions, but we won't know the exact details. And that's what most scientists believed. Einstein couldn't go along with that. He said, well, at the moment, your experimental evidence suggests this, but that's just because your experiments aren't there very good. I can give an example. Suppose you're trying to work out what's the air pressure inside a tire. You get a little gauge, you put it in that thing that comes out of the tire, and as the air hisses out, you measure the air pressure. Now, suppose I do that really badly. I stick the little gauge inside there, and I'm starting to measure the air pressure inside my car tire, and George and I, we start talking. And as we're talking, the air is hissing out. And then after a while, I say, oh, look, it says it's 3 pounds per square inch, 3 psi. And you say, David, you didn't do that very well. It was a poor experiment. I said, but that's what it says. No, the air, you were losing the air. Do it again, put the gauge on there, and real quickly look. I look real quickly, but even so, a little bit of the air came out. And quantum mechanics, again, this is an analogy, was a little bit like that. Everything they were finding, they're saying, we can't measure things exactly. The mere fact of measuring things sort of messes things up. Einstein said, well, that's just because your experiments, they're good, but they're not really perfected. Maybe one day you can find a better way to do it. And at the beginning, when Einstein began to say that in the mid-1920s, many physicists were on his side. But as time went on and they got better and better ways of measuring things, scientists began to think it was fundamental. They began to think this is the way things really were. What Einstein had, and one by one, they began to leave Einstein. When I was young, one of the people who had been on Einstein's side in the 1920s lived to be an old man in the 1970s, and I interviewed him in Paris. I was working in Paris then, Prince de Broglie, a Frenchman who won the Nobel Prize. And he said it was very poignant because he loved Einstein. Einstein had helped him in his career. He respected Einstein. And at first he thought, oh, yeah, of course, it's just an experimental flaw. But more and more evidence kept on backing up that there's this uncertainty, there's this fuzziness on the smallest level. So one by one, people like de Broglie left Einstein. And that really hurt Einstein. Somebody once said, somebody Einstein knew, so that thinkers are, they're kind of either tennis players or golfers. And think about it for yourself. Which one are you? You come to work on Monday morning or you meet family members and you say, I have a problem. There's something I have to work out. If you're a tennis player, you say, come on, let's get together. Let's huddle and work it out. At work, you put up a whiteboard and write about it with family members. Okay, come on, let's all talk. If you're a golfer, you meet everybody on Monday morning and say, oh, I have a problem. Guys, give me some space. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to go for a run. Give me some quiet space. I'm going to sit at a coffee shop for an hour. A golfer needs to think on their own. A tennis player needs to think through other people. Einstein, and think, which one are you? We're all a little bit of a mix, but we tend to go toward that direction. Einstein was a tennis player when he was young, and that's what he loved. He needed that interplay with other people. But one by one, his physicists left him and said, well, quantum mechanics, it seems to be true. All the evidence is showing it. He ended up becoming a golfer, and that's what really, really hurt his feelings. That's what left him isolated and sad as time went on. He's famous, you know, for saying that God does not play dice with the universe, that everything's like a book, that there's clarity, and if we don't see it, it's simply our weakness. You look harder and you'll see it. His good friend Niels Bohr would say to him, Einstein, stop telling God what to do. How do you know? How do you know? Maybe it is like a magazine. Maybe at the deepest level, we can't see what's exactly there. That led to a terrible isolation, and Einstein spent 10 years, 20 years, almost 30 years pretty much isolated from the mainstream in Princeton. He was at what's called the Princeton Institute of Advanced Studies, which was known in the trade as the Princeton Institute for Advanced Salaries. They paid a lot of money. Caltech wanted him and other places wanted him. And it was a nice enough town. But he missed that camaraderie. And there was a sort of isolation in his life. He would read aloud to his sister until she died. He would noodle away on the piano. He was friends with Marian Anderson, the great American singer. Whenever she came to town, she would come over and stay with him and stuff. He was nice to neighborhood friends, but something was missing. And the sad thing is this wasn't just a matter from getting very old and his mind not working well. His mind was sharp. At one point, way into his 50s, he came up with the notion of quantum entanglement, the idea that particles could be sitting at opposite sides of the galaxy, and what happens in one will match what happens in the other. And this is extraordinary. This now, in the early 21st century, we're making new quantum computers using those principles. And he came up with that as an older man. His brain was sharp, so the isolation wasn't just, oh, I've decided to retire and chill out. The isolation was he felt physics had taken a wrong turn. He felt not that he was an old man stodgily sticking to something that was out of date. He felt, no, this is the truth. These other people have lost their mind. Can't they see that there's this pattern behind everything? And the thing is, they didn't. I'm going to finish, before we get into questions, by reading the very end of the book, at the end of Einstein's life. He was 75. He was living in Princeton. It was 1955, and he was feeling. He knew he had heart problems. He had an aneurysm, a weakness, a thinness in one of the main blood vessels in his abdomen, coming from the heart. Rather than risk an operation, Einstein decided to continue with his work, as well as on public statements against nuclear weaponry. He tried to be stoic. Quote, "To think with fear of the end of one's life is pretty general with human beings," he admitted. "The fear is stupid, but it cannot be helped." He was anxious about his condition, and no doubt he wondered whether science would justify his isolated labor after all. In early April 1955, Einstein's heart condition worsened. His doctors explained that the aneurysm was tearing. The process would be slow at first, they said, then suddenly it would speed up. There was more talk of an operation, but Einstein was adamant. Quote, "It is tasteless to prolong life artificially. I have done my share," he said. He did ask what he would experience, how bad the pain would be, but they couldn't tell him anything for sure. They gave him an injection of morphine at home. It helped slightly. By Friday, April 15th, 1955, he was in such pain that he was driven to the hospital in Princeton. His stepdaughter, Margot, came. She barely recognized him. He was pale. His face was twisted in pain. Even so, she said, quote, "His personality was the same as ever. He joked with me. He awaited his end as an imminent natural phenomenon." His older son flew in from Berkeley, where he now worked as an engineering professor. Speaking to the boy, Einstein gestured to his equations, another effort to create a unified theory to bring together all known forces in the universe in a clear, predictable manner. Einstein said to his son, Riley, "If only I had more mathematics." Soon he felt a little bit better, and he even asked for his eyeglasses, as well as a pencil and his papers, so he could work on those calculations some more. But then in the early morning of Monday, April 18th, 1955, the aneurysm burst. He was alone. He was bleeding to death very quickly. He called out to a nurse, and when she arrived, he whispered to her. But she spoke no German, and so had no idea what the old man said before he died. Thank you. We now have time for some questions. So go ahead, either about the science or about Einstein's personality, implications for your own self or business. We have them there.
It's not a question, but I wanted to tell you that my father-in-law worked for Einstein.
Wow.
And he was an electric engineer. Mm-hmm. And Einstein had talked to Roosevelt during the war, we are behind in nuclear power, and we want to work on that. And so Einstein apparently asked my father-in-law to start a laboratory in Indonesia, where my father-in-law was living at the time. Mm-hmm. And with the condition, if the Japanese will invade Indonesia, you have to destroy the lab immediately. And that happened. And my father-in-law destroyed the lab with the help of other engineers. Mm-hmm. And they were all taken to Japan eventually with their families. Like,
wow.
My former husband lived 3 years in Japan in a temple, mm-hmm, with those engineers. Yes, I just wanted to tell you this.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I'd like to remind our audiences that are listening to David Budanis speaking about Einstein's greatest mistake, his book, and more questions.
Wasn't there a recent discovery related to the solar system that sort of tied in one of Einstein's loose ends that proved he was, like, even more a genius?
Oh, yeah. There's an amazing discovery of evidence of what's called gravitational waves. We know that waves are really weird things. If there's a storm, say, in the Atlantic Ocean, and then waves start coming up a little while later, say, in North Carolina on the shore, it isn't that the water from the middle of the Atlantic has traveled all the way to North Carolina. It's a wave. The water in the middle of the Atlantic hits water a bit to the left of it, to the west of it. That water hits other water. It keeps on pushing, and then you feel the result over North Carolina or in New York. If you have a wave in air, if I speak to somebody in the back of this room, the air, and I don't push the air next to my mouth to somebody maybe 30, 20 yards away. Rather, the air in front of me pushes the air next to it. That puts the air next to it. It's like dominoes. Anyways, Einstein, in the 1930s, predicted that the same thing would happen with gravity, that if there was a big gravitational event, he didn't know about black holes, but we think of, say, a black hole exploding or two black holes colliding, it would be like an accordion would go through space. The space itself would contract and expand and contract and expand, and it would push this wave across. So it doesn't mean the distant black hole would come here, but that pushes that space next to it, that pushes the space next to that, and it would wobble in and out like an accordion. Well, people thought, even Einstein in the 1930s thought, this is a theoretical possibility, but clearly we can never record it. How can you see space itself stretching out and then squeezing in? Turns out teams of incredibly ingenious experimental physicists discovered this just a few months ago. Definitely they deserve the Nobel Prize. It actually happens.
Well, I have a question about waves. And there's another kind of wave where photons travel in waves, but there's actually an object going through rather than going through a medium. So what's the difference between the waves through a medium, like water or air that you just described, and actual particles moving in a way that we measure as waves?
People often say, oh, that's a good question, and it's hard to answer. That's such a good question that there's really no answer. This is what tormented Einstein. He was actually responsible for coming up with some of the ideas embedded within your question. Is light, is it a wave, is it a particle? And in a sense, it's a little bit of both. But how could that be? What does it mean that it's a particle and a wave? Well, it turns out things happen in the world around us, which we're kind of used to, which we can see, and we have an intuition for it. For example, we know that if I'm at a concert, say in Golden Gate Park, and I put a loud music player down, it'll be really loud right next to the speakers. But if I walk pretty far away, 100 yards, 200 yards, 300 yards, it'll be a lot softer. Now, suppose there's creatures who are really small, like ants. Suppose there's ants living in Golden Gate Park, right? And some of them are right next to the speaker, and they say, wow, it's loud, it's 120 decibels. And there's other ants that live 300 yards away, and they say, no, it's soft, it's 20 decibels, it's 30 decibels. Now, we as humans, we know that sound diminishes over distance. But to the ants, that's insane. How can sound change? Sound is. It's a certain volume, right? So we have we have an intuition about it because we can actually walk the 300 yards and feel the difference. Another example, before trains were going in the very early 1800s, there was a man named Christian Doppler who made a prediction. He said, one day in the distant future, if humans ever go 30, 35, or even 40 miles an hour, a powerful effect will occur. And his name was Doppler, and it's the Doppler effect, which you can hear when you're on the highway. You know, a police car comes at you, the sound changes frequency. And we're used to that because at 40, 50, 60 miles an hour, it's easy to hear. Nobody had experienced that when Doppler first came up with his ideas. And people said, how could that be? How could sound change? It's sound is sound. It doesn't change. But that's because nobody had ever traveled at those speeds. In the same way, Einstein's relativity makes all these strange predictions. For example, this is a bit of a plot spoiler from Star Wars, but there's a close connection between Princess Leia and Luke Skywalker, if you didn't know that. At one point in the Star Wars movies, Luke Skywalker is living on a particular planet, and Princess Leia goes off on this big journey across the galaxy and comes back. Well, I did some calculations estimating the size of the galaxy, and there's a little bit of an inaccuracy in the Star Wars films. She would have aged maybe a year or two while she did those travels. Luke would be about 60,000 years old. It's possible that he moisturized really, really well. So we have no intuition about these things because we don't live in those realms. But Einstein used his incredible ability, just the way Christian Doppler did, or just the way maybe, if you imagine a genius ant in Golden Gate Park could do, to see these, predict these experiences which humans can't see in front of them. He was extraordinary at that.
Next question.
Oh, there's one right here.
Very simple. This is a really simple question, but was his front door really painted red?
Oh, go ahead.
So that he could identify where it was he lived. He was so brilliant, and yet he didn't remember which house it was he lived in.
That I don't think is the case. It turns out famous people always get anecdotes about them. They acquire them. And when I did the research, there were all sorts of things I was looking for. Was he dyslexic? Was he this? Was he that? Was he a poor student? And I found that there are some things that are well-based. So his sister, Maya, spelled M-A-J-A, wrote a memoir, which is pretty trustworthy. All the dates and stuff match. There was a Professor Dagenhardt at his high school in Munich. But a lot of other stories were built up, accreted around them, like stories about, I don't know, Mark Twain or Winston Churchill, something like that. And people liked the idea that this great mind was impractical. In fact, he had, as I mentioned, he was really good with his hands. He liked building stuff. He was also sensible with money. There was terrible inflations in Germany in the 1920s, so he needed some foreign currency, and he was a good inventor. He worked on gyroscopes, and he invented some very ingenious refrigerators that used magnets rather than gases inside. Curiously, in 2016, in the news, somebody created a useful refrigerator using Einstein's technique for keeping vaccines at cold, at a constant temperature, in third world countries. So he was good and practical in that respect. What people loved about him, he started getting famous in 1919, what they loved was his informality. So it wasn't a lack of common sense, but it was informality. Around 1920, he was giving a lecture at the University of Vienna, and all the press photographers were there waiting for the train to come in from Berlin. And they were standing by the first class compartment with their flash cameras ready. One passenger after another came out, and there was no Einstein. And they didn't know what had happened. He was supposed to be there. Then somebody said, look. They looked all the way down the platform. And at the far end, coming from the third class compartment, there was this man with his violin case and his little suitcase and his pipe, just as content as could be. And that was Einstein.
Next question.
Maybe this is a little dumb of me, but I don't know exactly what quantum mechanics are. Can you explain that to us?
There's some parts of what Einstein did that are easy to explain. If you'd asked me what equals mc squared means, I could tell you that really well. Quantum mechanics is hard to get into detail, but quantum mechanics is the study of the ultra small. I can give a rough analogy. Before 1900, people thought that if there were atoms floating around, that they would maybe be like little solar systems. When atoms were first seen as being like little solar systems, you know, the sun at the center and planets going around, or the nucleus at the center and electrons going around, that was in the 19-teens. Niels Bohr, in fact, was central to that. And at the beginning, people thought, well, it's just like a little solar system. It just goes around smoothly. If an electron moves from one place to another, it'd be like the Earth moving on a further orbit out to Mars or a closer orbit down to Mercury. But then people found that strange things happen. Imagine if in our solar system we're sitting around at Earth and then whoop, suddenly we're sitting right next to Jupiter and we never crossed the space in between. We just whoop, jumped. We made this jump in a sudden quanta or a distance, a certain quantity or amount. We just made this jump. We couldn't predict exactly when it would happen, and we never covered the intervening space. We just appeared over there. And that just seemed insane to Einstein. It's like, we think we see that, but it's not really happening. And those are the sort of effects. Again, this is only an analogy, but it's a pretty good analogy. And those are the sort of effects that quantum mechanics deals with. And the strange thing, and this is what's really weird about it, you can't get your head around it very well, it actually holds up. The circuits inside our phones depend on those effects. They depend on things moving around like that. It's very, very peculiar. I can give maybe a slightly better example. It turns out quantum mechanics makes the insight that when something goes slowly, it's you can't measure its position very well. So suppose I throw a baseball at somebody's glove, right? Being from Chicago, I'm very excited about the Chicago Cubs. And I'm used to disappointment, being from Chicago and being very excited about the Chicago Cubs. Okay, suppose somebody throws a baseball and a second baseman puts his glove out and catches it. If this was happening on the tiny realm in quantum mechanics, where again, it's very different from our intuitions, if he threw the ball really fast, the glove would shrink. It'd be a tiny glove. You'd have to be in the exact right position to catch it. If he threw the ball slowly, the glove would get wider and wider and wider. It'd be as a catcher's mitt. And if he threw the ball really slowly, just tossed it slowly, the glove might be 10 feet wide. Now, this seems insane, but it turns out it actually happens. When you want to make an atomic bomb, if you shoot fast neutrons around, they miss their targets. If you throw the neutrons very, very slowly, the target gets bigger and the neutron hits the target. How very weird is that? We have no intuition for it. We can merely describe it.
Thank you.
Next question.
We often hear that Einstein's blunder, or his biggest mistake, also turned out to be one of his greatest insights that he didn't recognize at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I never quite understood how that worked. So the idea of the cosmological constant as being something that in his day didn't make sense according to his own equations, but mm-hmm. now, as we see the universe is expanding faster and faster and faster,
yeah,
we see that as perhaps an insight that he might embrace today, but he didn't then.
Correct. Yeah, I can elaborate on that in a way that might be more helpful. In the 1920s, Einstein had this beautiful, simple equation, which he thought was almost a sign of God's clarity, that he was able to see it. And then he had to modify it. He had to throw in this special term that he indeed, as you said, he called a cosmological constant. And this cosmological constant, it could be like a brake or an accelerator. It would, if you just threw it in, it would change that simple vision that I described of a sagging trampoline, and it could make it sag more, make it sag less. It would be like a sort of a control, like just making it more or less, like sort of like an adjustment in a car. What are the RPMs going to be? What's the bass and treble in a sound system going to be? And Einstein thought it was ugly. It didn't really fit. It was an ingenious way to sort of calibrate what was going on. And with great pleasure, he got rid of it in 1930 and 1931. It turns out, just before the year 2000, a team in California and a team in Australia found out that not only is the universe expanding, but it's expanding ever faster. It'd be like I toss an apple up in the air, and instead of just going at a certain speed, it suddenly zooms off even faster. How utterly amazing. And it turns out a nice way to explain that, they realized, oh my God, we could use that same mathematical trick Einstein used, the one that he got rid of after a while. We could just throw in an extra term and just set the dial for enhanced expansion, like that. So they used his. He was really ingenious. Even the mistakes that a genius makes are still pretty useful. I'd love to see Steve Jobs' outbox. He said, nah, this isn't good enough. I'll put it, let me see. We can modify it.
Other questions? One of the things you talked about before about quantum mechanics and seeing and the effect of our seeing on those tiny activities. How do we see? To me, it's a very interesting part of the question. We always say we talk about seeing and that if somebody observes something on the quantum level, that you actually affect it. But we don't affect it with our magical eyesight. Mm-hmm. We affect it with photons or something else bouncing off of something and bouncing back into our eyes, and so we see it. And if something is smaller than a photon, it would seem like the photons are doing the affecting, not our vision.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, when we see things or we can't, the blurriness of quantum mechanics seems to be that as you get closer and closer to the tiniest particle that there would be, you would have nothing to bounce off. I mean, we bounce millions and millions of photons off of each other to see each other.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the smallest particle, the only thing you could bounce off was something its size. So
right.
How could you see it so well? I was wondering if that, you know, plays into how precise it is. Maybe Einstein had a fundamental intuition about the precision is there, we just can't see it.
The argument that you just gave is very central to the history of physics. That's very much the argument that Heisenberg gave in the late 1920s when he came up with the uncertainty principle. If you know, what I was saying about using a tire gauge to measure the air pressure inside a tire, if I'm klutzy about it, I'm just wasting, the air is just shooting out. In the same way, if I want to detect how something's moving, clearly if I throw 100 balls at it, baseballs, it'll knock it out of position. So you think if I want to measure, throw something you can barely see. If I want to measure something, maybe just throw a single photon at it, which will touch it very gently, poop, and bounce back. But if the thing is large, like, I don't know, a rhinoceros running around or something like that, a photon won't affect it, and I can see it pretty accurately, or I can tell it, you know, roughly what it is. I can even send lots of photons. But if something's small enough, maybe the size level of a photon or even smaller, just throwing that will knock it out of position. So the details get a bit more technical, but that's the sort of reasoning that Heisenberg went through in 1927. It convinced gradually many physicists that there was an indication of something profound. Einstein said, well, what you're describing is only because we can't imagine doing it better. If we can maybe find some ingenious way, and he thought of all sorts of mechanisms that avoided that. Maybe you can measure things by, for example, measuring the change in weight as something moves around. Mm-hmm. Maybe then we could get away from it. And he tried time after time. I'm writing actually a theater play about a time in 1930 in Brussels. I should emphasize, and apologies to any Belgians here, but one of the best things you can do in Brussels is spend your time thinking about the sky and the stars and not that much about Brussels itself. It's a great... That was very mean, and I should take it back. I've had very nice times in Brussels. Anyways, Einstein and his good friend Niels Bohr, who had been real buddies before, really... they meant a lot to each other. Niels Bohr would even share his favorite smelly Danish cheese with Einstein. And for a Danish man, that's a mark of real commitment. They were close, they shared a lot, but they argued. They had this final argument in 1930 in Brussels where Einstein would come up with one mechanism after another to get around exactly what you described. Well, okay, throwing a photon will knock something small out of position. Can I do something different? Can I try that? And each time, Niels Bohr would rebut him. And there was one time Einstein came up with a magnificent idea, a complicated mechanism that you hang from a scale and use a clock and all sorts of stuff. And Niels Bohr couldn't find a refutation. And he realized, oh my God, if this is true, if Einstein's come up with a refutation, then quantum mechanics is wrong. And Niels Bohr would wake people at night into the hotel. And there's a photograph of Niels Bohr and Einstein when Einstein had it. And it's the last photograph. It's from mid-1930. It's one of the last photographs I've seen of Einstein being genuinely happy, even though he lived for 25 more years, because he felt that finally he had brought physics back to the right, safe place. Turns out, in the morning, Niels Bohr had cracked it and said, Einstein, there's a mistake in your experiment. Einstein said, Niels, what was it? He said, you didn't take into account the theory of relativity. And it turns out there was a mistake having to do with the theory of relativity. Einstein had a good enough grace to say, you're right. And he helped Niels Bohr go through the calculations. And indeed, it didn't disprove it. But yet, Einstein didn't change his view. All I can compare it to, if there's something you have a very strong moral feeling about, and you argue, say, with a really skilled lawyer who's very good, who does verbal judo and flips you around, you can lose the argument, but you're still convinced that you're right. And that's what Einstein was like.
What was Einstein's take on extraterrestrial life?
He didn't, to the best of my knowledge, he didn't do any direct writings about it, but he would have no problems with the idea of life independently forming on other planets. He was fascinated with how dealing with external groups can either bring us together or tear us apart. So there were some times, a good example, when Germany, where he'd grown up in, and where he lived in the 19-teens and 20s and early 30s, at times under external threat, the people there would pull together. At times they would pull together in a nasty way. At times they would fall apart in dissension. Think of the United States when there's a recession. It can bring us together. You know, we have to, batten down and help each other, more solidarity, or families have to help each other. Sometimes teenage kids who are difficult, if the family suffers economically, they'll actually do much better. The teenagers stop being petulant and they really want to help. Or real pressure, like a recession, can tear us apart. People get furious at each other, and they grab, and they sunder demanding things. So Einstein was aware of both those perspectives in human beings. Sometimes he was disgusted by human beings when living through Nazi Germany or the start of it. His books were burned. Not only were his books burned on the street by uneducated mobs, they were burned at the greatest university in Germany, Göttingen, the greatest university in the world at that time. And groups of students, graduate students and undergraduates, with glee they burned his books and those of others. And he thought, you know, there's a capacity in human beings which is not admirable. Luckily, he wasn't a total pessimist. He knew that that capacity exists, but also there's other capacities, a very positive, sweet capacity. And our job, he used a real lot of his income. I told you he created patents, he had a good salary in Princeton, and he gave a vast amount of it away to get refugees out of Germany so they could survive.
How did you switch from teaching to writing? Because you it's a personal on your own history, but you did a lot of teaching. And at what point did you decide to start putting it into books? And how did you make that decision?
I enjoyed the teaching. And to be a really good teacher, you have to be very generous. And it turns out I can be temporarily generous. So I would teach like one term a year or two terms a year, and I'd really get into it. And I'd give detailed lecture notes to the students, and I would try to think of nice demonstrations and stuff like that. And I'd connect, and we'd go for walks afterwards. And I found that I could do that or I could do writing, but I couldn't do both. It sort of got in the way. And it was sort of like raising children. Raising children, which I've done, was the most sweetest, most wonderful thing, but you lose some of yourself. It's like you're really busy, you give them a good time, and you have a good time. You're happy while you do it, but some of the other things you wish to do slide through your finger. Luckily, if one has a bit of an income, we can use modern technology to help. You can like have babysitters, things like that. So you can do both, which indeed is what I did. But someone like Einstein's first wife, Mileva, that's what she suffered from. Cleaning the apartment, she had to do her own. Baby formula, all that sort of stuff, they had to do on their own. And that can sort of tear you apart. You can kind of lose who you are. I always think the key thing is to get a balance. If you're the great Rabbi Hillel saying, if you're 2,000 years ago, if you're only for yourself, well, what sort of animal are you? That's very selfish. But if you're not for yourself, who are you? You've lost yourself. If you're too generous, you disappear. And if you're only selfish, we need friends and camaraderie. It's getting the balance right. Einstein, he got the balance right when it came to studying the universe. He didn't get the balance right with the warmth in his life that he really, really wanted.
But you talked a lot about his sister. Now, his sister was one of his most profound relationships, and people ask a lot of questions about that. So, and he lived with her for most of his life after he got divorced, right?
So his sister was just a few years younger than him. And she studied. She wasn't a scientist. She studied Romance languages. She was a good. Einstein was a terrible linguist. He spoke French almost as badly as I do. Okay. It was really embarrassing when he would start. His English was, put it this way: if you only heard him speak English, you wouldn't think this was the greatest mind in the world. But his sister had all the linguistic ability in the family. And I mentioned that Einstein lived in a high school, went to a remedial year of high school with a family near Zurich. And he dated a girl there, and it didn't work. That girl had a brother, and that brother is who Maya married. So the families were close. And so Maya attended his lectures when she was young, when he didn't have enough students. So she was really diligent and supported him. And she was fairly happily married. She lived mostly in Italy. And then her marriage began to fall apart. Plus, of course, she was Jewish. And although Italy wasn't as anti-Semitic as Germany, it just felt it was dangerous there. So she came to America, and her husband didn't. And so Einstein let her stay at the house in Princeton and stuff. And for a while, you know, his wife was there, and he had a grown stepdaughter from his second wife. From her, his secretary lived in the house. So it was kind of nice. But then after a while, his second wife died. Maya died. Before she died, she had a sort of stroke, and she couldn't really walk around or even communicate well. But she could still take things in intellectually. And Einstein did a wonderful thing. Every afternoon, he would walk a mile or two back from the Princeton campus. He'd walk home to this house on Mercer Street, climb up to her room, and he'd read her aloud the books that she loved. And she would nod that she could still take them in, especially Dostoevsky. But she also liked Ellery Queen, the detective.
All right. There's time for one more question.
When did he move to the United States?
Einstein moved to the United States in 1933. One of the things he did on, he had visited before, and one of the things he did on his first day when he arrived, because they were worried for security, his boat docked in New York City, and he went on a fast, either a boat or a car, to Princeton, New Jersey, and he went to an ice cream shop. And there was something peculiar that he saw being served, a special receptacle, a device for carrying food, which it seemed he wasn't familiar with. He looked at the ice cream, he looked at this device, he looked at the ice cream, he looked at the device again, and because his English was still pretty bad, with his thumb, he pointed at both of them. The waitress took the vanilla ice cream, put it in the ice cream cone, and gave it to him. That was in all the newspapers the next day, and she said, "This was the greatest day of my life."
Thank you for making this one of the better days of ours.
Thank you.
And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.